From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
But investigators will discover a disturbing pattern of CIA alliances with warlords, colonels, and criminals who used CIA protection to deal in drugs. Suffering from mission myopia, CIA agents regarded narcotics as mere fallout.
We look at U.S. drug policy in light of the Helms-Weld standoff, and on this first day of Latino Heritage Month, we go to Mexico City, where tens of thousands of Zapatistas and their supporters rallied, and the FZLN, a new political party, is born. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a major change in policy, the Clinton administration has told its allies this weekend that it could sign a treaty banning anti-personnel landmines under a compromise that would allow it an additional 9 years before it begins to remove mines in the Korean Peninsula. Until today, the United States has said it could not sign any treaty that limited its ability to use anti-personnel mines to defend South Korea from an attack from the North. And this news from Texas rejecting the unanimous recommendation of the Texas State Board of Pardons and of the judge and prosecutors in the case. Governor George Bush has declined to grant a pardon to a Houston man who spent 12 years in prison for a rape that DNA testing later indicated he did not commit. A lawyer for the convicted man has accused the governor, a potential presidential aspirant, of bending to concerns over the political fallout of pardoning a convicted rapist, even one that prosecutors now say they believe is innocent of the crime. Kevin Byrd was released on bail this summer, but he has not been cleared of the crime, and nearly everyone involved in the case has recommended a pardon as the most efficient way to clear his name. Police did not crack the case in 1985 until 4 months after the crime was committed, when the victim saw Byrd in a grocery store and told her husband and then the police that he had raped her. Byrd was arrested, and despite her initial statement to police that her assailant was white, Mr. Byrd is black, he was convicted of the crime. This news from California, the San Francisco Bay Area's commuter rail system was ready to roll again today. After a week-long strike by union workers, idled trains and created traffic nightmares for commuters. Bay Area rapid transit trains haven't run since September 6th, the day before 2,600 transit workers walked off the job in a wage dispute. Under the tentative agreement, employees would receive a $3,000 lump sum payment the first year of the four-year contract. They would then receive 4% raises in the second, third, and fourth years. Employees of the two unions, Service Employees International Union Local 790 and Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1555, will vote on the deal on Friday. The nine-member BART board votes the following week. Approval is expected to be a formality. The strike was the longest in BART's 25-year history since a three-month walkout in 1979. Trying to mend ties to his Christian conservative base, House Speaker Newt Gingrich on Saturday condemned abortion, religious persecution, and trial lawyers playing litigation lottery with tobacco lawsuits. He was a featured speaker at the Christian Coalition's Road to Victory conference that drew five other Republicans mulling presidential bids. Republican John Kasich of Ohio, Lamar Alexander, Steve Forbes, Alan Keyes, and Senator John Ashcroft of Missouri. The House Speaker, once the darling of the conservative movement, promised to pass the so-called partial birth abortion ban again and dare President Clinton to veto it again. Burglary, not a mistaken search for a bail jumper, was the reason five bounty hunters in black ski masks and body armor broke into a home and shot a couple to death last month in Arizona. Prosecutors said the men had worked as bounty hunters in the past, but their story of a tragic case of mistaken identity and their search for a California bail jumper didn't pan out. The warrant for the bail jumper had expired, and police could find no connection between the bail jumper and the victims. Also, the company they said they were working for has denied sending them. This news from the Middle East, Israeli police deployed in large numbers today to protect flag-waving Jewish settlers who took over two buildings in the middle of an Arab neighborhood in Jerusalem. Palestinians warned violence would erupt unless the settlers were evicted immediately from the Ras Al Ahmed neighborhood in East Jerusalem. Police said the takeover Sunday night was legal because a Palestinian family had sold the house to a Miami-based businessman. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was to decide today whether to evict the settlers for national security reasons, he said. And Air Force investigators are looking to the flight data recorder and debris strewn across a neighborhood to help explain why an F-117A stealth fighter broke apart and crashed during an air show. The crash Sunday afternoon set two houses on fire and slightly injured six people on the ground, including an elderly woman. The pilot ejected safely. Amateur video showed a piece of the aircraft, apparently from the tail or a wing, flying off before the wedge-shaped jet went into a slow spin and crashed about a mile from 12,000 viewers at the Chesapeake Air Show. The cost of the stealth fighter jet is estimated to be about $45 million. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore this weekend opened the 27th annual legislative conference of the Congressional Black Caucus. While the president and vice president hailed the caucus as the conscience of the nation and received a warm welcome at the festivities in Washington's Union Station, there remain several areas of sharp disagreement between the White House and many black congressional representatives. Los Angeles Congressmember Maxine Waters, the California Democrat and chair of the Black Caucus, again slammed the administration this weekend over its decision to maintain stiffer mandatory sentencing for possession of crack cocaine versus powdered cocaine, which she charges unfairly discriminates against black offenders. Waters also voiced frustration that Clinton, in his budget negotiations with congressional Republicans, agreed to drop the $5 billion that caucus members sought to repair dilapidated schools in mostly urban areas. But also taking center stage at the Black Congressional Caucus's legislative conference has been the issue of the CIA's relationship to international narcotics trafficking. In one session over the weekend, a number of people spoke, including Gary Webb, the reporter from the San Jose Mercury News, talking about the Dark Alliance, the relationship between Contra cocaine traffickers and the Central Intelligence Agency. Another of the speakers was Professor Alfred McCoy, a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and author of the book The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. This is what Professor McCoy had to say as he outlined 40 years of U.S. policy around drugs.
What I want to do is to give you background, historical background, on Gary Webb's story. Congresswoman Waters, has come here and told us that she believes that Gary Webb's story is accurate. The CIA director could walk in here and say, "Trust me, it's not true. We wouldn't do that." So how do we know? How do we judge criminal behavior? One of the things we look at is prior offenses. What I want to do now is look at the history of what the CIA did during the 40 years of the Cold War, and show how there were repeated alliances between drug traffickers in Asia and Latin America and the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. Now, in August of last year, as you know, the San Jose Mercury News reported that the Nicaraguans' CIA-backed Contras delivered tons of cocaine to L.A. gangs in the 1980s. This story sparked a major national media controversy. The Mercury concluded in its editorial on the series, and I quote, "The Contra-run drug network opened the first conduit between Colombia's cartels and LA's black neighborhoods. It's impossible to believe that the Central Intelligence Agency didn't know," end quote. At first, the story attracted little notice. Then the Congressional Black Caucus demanded investigation. But then CIA Director John Deutsch shot back, quote, "The agency neither participated in nor condoned drug trafficking by the Contra forces." Responding to pressure that rose across the country from the mainstream press, last May, Gary Webb's editor, the editor of the San Jose Mercury News, Mr. Jerry Seppos, published a remarkable front page apology that was seen to be a virtual retraction of the story. In an op-ed for the New York Times, John Deutsch, who was by then retired from the CIA, use the occasion to issue a broad denial, carefully and cleverly worded, to say, quote, the CIA has never directed or knowingly condoned drug smuggling into the United States. He added, quote, dedicated CIA analysts and agents who frequently run grave personal risks in fighting drugs deserve to have these allegations fully put to rest. Before we grant the general absolution that Director Deutsch demands, it's time to ask some hard questions about the CIA and the traffic in drugs. First, did the agency ever, at any point in the Cold War, ally with drug traffickers? Second, did the CIA ever protect these drug traffickers from prosecution? And third, did the CIA encourage drug smugglers to target African Americans? Let's now look at the past and find the answers to these questions. Throughout the Cold War, the CIA used gangsters and warlords, many of them drug dealers, to fight communists. In one of history's accidents, the Iron Curtain fell along an Asian opium zone that stretches for 5,000 miles from Turkey to Thailand. In Burma in the 1950s, in Laos in the 1960s, in Afghanistan in the 1980s, the CIA used Highland warlords to mobilize tribal armies against the Soviet Union and Communist China. These leaders, these warlords, exploited the CIA alliance to become drug lords, expanding local opium production and exporting refined heroin. The agency tolerated such trafficking and, when necessary, blocked investigations. Since ruthless drug lords made effective anti-communist allies and heroin profits amplified their power, CIA agents did not tamper with what they believed were the demands of success in such delicate covert operations. Let's look at the first of these operations in Laos in the 1960s and 1970s. In Asia, distance insulated the CIA from the consequences of its complicity with the drug dealers. In Laos in the 1960s, the CIA battled communists with a secret army of 30,000 Hmong, tough Highlanders whose only cash crop was opium. A handful of CIA agents relied on tribal leaders to motivate their troops and the Laotian generals to protect the cover of this secret operation. When Hmong officers loaded opium on the CIA's Air America and the Lao Army's commander opened a heroin laboratory, the biggest in the world, the agency was silent. Quote, the past involvement of many of these officers in drugs is well known, said the CIA Inspector General in a secret 1972 report. Quote, yet their goodwill considerably facilitates the military activities of agency-supported irregulars. By 1971, 34%, one-third, of all U.S. soldiers fighting in South Vietnam were heroin addicts, and they were all supplied from laboratories operated by these CIA allies. When I went to Laos in 1971 to investigate, the Lao Army commander, the operator of that heroin lab, graciously opened his opium accounts, but the U.S. mission stonewalled. In a Hmong tribal village in the mountains where we were investigating opium shipments on Air America, the CIA's airline, CIA mercenaries ambushed my research team. A CIA operative threatened to murder my Lao interpreter unless I quit. When my book was in press, the CIA's deputy director of plans, that's covered operations, made a personal visit to the offices of my publisher in New York to pressure my publisher to suppress my book. The CIA's general counsel demanded deletions. After the book was published, unaltered, CIA agents in Laos pressed my sources to retract, and they convinced the House Foreign Relations Committee that my allegations were baseless. By 1974, Southeast Asian syndicates were supplying a quarter of U.S. heroin supply with heroin from the so-called Golden Triangle region of Southeast Asia. But Asia was too remote for allegations of CIA complicity to pack any political punch. Now let's look at the second major CIA operation, Afghanistan. In 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and the Sandinistas seized Nicaragua, prompting two major CIA operations with some very revealing similarities. During the 1980s, the CIA, working through Pakistani intelligence, spent $2 billion supporting the Islamic resistance to the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. In the 1970s, it's important to understand that before this operation began, there was a limited amount of local opium grown for local markets. There was no heroin in this region. Within 2 years after the start of this operation, the Pakistan-Afghanistan borderlands became the world's number one heroin producer, supplying 60% of the United States heroin supply. In Pakistan itself, the number of addicts, the number of heroin addicts, went from zero in 1979 to 1,200,000 in 6 years. Again, CIA assets controlled this heroin trade. As the Afghan guerrillas seized territory inside Afghanistan, they forced local peasants to plant opium as a revolutionary tax. Across the border, Afghan leaders and local dealers operated heroin laboratories under the protection of Pakistan intelligence. In May 1990, as the operation was ending, the Washington Post reported that Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the CIA's favorite Afghan asset who'd received $1 billion in U.S. aid, was a top heroin trafficker. During this entire decade, when Pakistan was the world's major heroin supplier, the large DEA contingent inside that country made no seizures, made no arrests. In 1995, the former CIA director of the Afghan operation, Mr. Charles Cogan, admitted that he had sacrificed the drug war to fight the Cold War. Quote, "Our main mission was to do as much damage as possible to the Soviets. We really didn't have the resources or the time to devote to an investigation of the drug trade," he told Australian television. Quote, "I don't think we need to apologize for this. Every situation has its fallout. There was fallout in terms of drugs, yes, but the main objective was accomplished. The Soviets left Afghanistan," end quote. Again, distance insulated the CIA from political fallout. Once the heroin left Pakistan, the Sicilian mafia exported it to the United States and local gangs sold it on the street. Eventually, by the end of the 1980s, U.S. drug agents arrested middle-aged Sicilian immigrants at pizza parlors from Boston to Wisconsin in the famous Pizza Connection case of the 1980s. Not surprisingly, most Americans did not make the equation between Afghan drug lords, pizza parlors, and the heroin in their streets. In Central America, however, simple proximity has made the political fallout from this CIA operation explosive. Proximity brought these operations to the attention of Congress. In the late 1980s, Senator John Kerry's subcommittee investigated and found substantial links between the Contras and the cocaine traffic. The Drug Enforcement Administration operative, the DEA operative, assigned to Honduras, a Mr. Thomas Cepeda, testified that his office had been closed in June 1983 since it was generating intelligence that the local Honduran military was involved in cocaine smuggling. His intelligence was threatening the CIA's relationship with the Honduran military in this key frontline state for the Contra operation. In effect, CIA operations had once again created a de facto zone of protection closed to investigations of drug trafficking. The Mercury story by Gary Webb tries to go to the next step. It tries to establish a direct link to the distribution of drugs in the United States. When the agency hired Colonel Enrique Bermudez to organize the main Contra Army in 1981, the colonel, according to Gary Webb's story, used two U.S.-based Contras to deliver drug profits. Unlike the CIA's Asian warlords, the Contras and their allies did not produce drugs. The only way they could make money from drugs was to smuggle them into the United States and sell them to Americans. As it was then doing in Afghanistan, the CIA ignored the traffic in Central America and blocked investigations. while the agency's relations with Asian drug lords were lost in the mist of faraway mountains, Representative Maxine Waters now has police documents to charge the CIA with protecting Contra cocaine dealers. If Congress investigates, I have a good idea what it might find. I personally doubt there is direct evidence that the CIA actually trafficked in drugs or targeted any Americans, whether GIs in South Vietnam or African Americans in South Central. But investigators will discover a disturbing pattern of CIA alliances with warlords, colonels, and criminals who use CIA protection to deal in drugs. Suffering from mission myopia, CIA agents regarded narcotics as mere fallout. For CIA agents in Laos, the heroin epidemics among GIs in Vietnam was only fallout. For CIA agents in Pakistan and Central America, drug shipments to African American communities in the United States were just fallout. For the Vietnam vets and the African Americans and others who live with the pain of this fallout, these findings, I think, will be profoundly disturbing. But they will be better for this nation's political health than the CIA's blanket denials, which lack credibility in face of the steadily mounting evidence of a consistent pattern of CIA alliances with drug lords and drug traffic throughout the 40 years of the Cold War. Thank you.
And that was Professor Alfred McCoy, Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin at Madison and the author of The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. He was speaking at the Congressional Black Caucus Legislative Weekend over the past few days. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott yesterday again insisted that the nomination of former Massachusetts Republican Governor William Weld to be ambassador to Mexico is dead. And Lott, speaking on CBS's Face the Nation, also said he's urged President Bill Clinton to move away from his nominee. But the White House and Governor Weld are not budging, at least for now. The fight stepped up on Friday when, in a PAC committee hearing, Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Jesse Helms rejected any possibility of confirming Weld. Pacifica Radio's Don Rush was there, and he filed this report.
Order will come to order. I unhesitatingly schedule this special meeting of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in response to...
The atmosphere was a testy one as Committee Chair Jesse Helms stared down supporters of William Weld's nomination to be the next U.S. ambassador to Mexico. Helms refuses to even allow the committee to hold a hearing on Weld's nomination. So a majority on the committee had forced the North Carolina Republican to hold a meeting on the subject. But Helms used Senate rules to effectively filibuster today's session, allowing only a brief statement by Joseph Biden, the ranking Democrat on the committee.
I think we're making a mistake here. I think that we should, although technically you are correct, I believe the spirit of the rule, which I will not bother to read now, which I put out in a statement, which you're fully aware of, calls for and envisions more comedy on this kind of issue.
Helms charges Weld with being soft on drugs. But Helms has taken a lot of sharp criticism, calling his refusal to hold a hearing on the nomination unprecedented. Today, the North Carolina Republican took exception, citing a report by the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service.
During the past 10 years alone, there have been 154 failed nominees who never received a hearing. Unprecedented? You make up your own mind about that. Let me repeat, there have been 154 nominations in the past 10 years alone which died in committee without a Senate hearing because a chairman or a ranking member or someone else didn't want a hearing.
Helms took special aim at Indiana Republican Richard Lugar, who had forced today's meeting. He noted that Lugar had been guilty of blocking a hearing on a presidential nomination. That prompted Minnesota Democrat Paul Wellstone to interrupt Helms' long statement.
Mr. Chairman, can Senator Lugar respond to this?
No, I will not.
Shouldn't he have a right to be able to?
The committee will be in order.
I think there should be due process.
I'm not going to debate with the Senator.
I just think there should be fairness here. Senator Lugar should have a chance to respond.
That was not the only colleague that the angry Helms gaveled into silence. And at the end of 30 minutes, the session was over with Helms getting the last word. So now Wells supporters are turning their attention to Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott to pave the way for the full Senate to order the committee to send Wells' nomination to the floor. But Lott has already called for President Clinton to withdraw the nomination. So Biden and Wellstone told reporters they would try to pressure Lott into acting by drumming up public pressure. First, Biden.
Who do you think would more likely yield to national pressure? Helms or Lott? What do you think?
And there will be the national pressure.
During the committee meeting, Weld looked on with a slight smile of amusement as he watched Helms wield his gavel. Outside the hearing room, he took another sharp shot at Helms while expressing optimism about the future of his nomination.
We're a majority of the members not only of the Foreign Relations Committee, but of the United States Senate, have declared their view that there should be a fair hearing for the president's nominee. It is quite clear that the attempt by a member to demonstrate that the Senate is at bottom a despotic institution is bound ultimately to fail.
Back at the White House, President Clinton once again called for a hearing on Wells' nomination. But Clinton stayed away from any harsh criticism of Helms.
I think Governor Wells would be a good ambassador. He doesn't. I think whether you believe he'd be good or not, he's entitled to a hearing, especially when a majority of the members of the committee and a majority of the members of the Senate want him to have it. And so that's where I am, and we're at loggerheads now. As Senator Lott operates the Senate under the Senate rules, and they may well have the ability to prevent this from ever happening. And they may prevail, but the battle is not over yet.
Don Rush, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Joining us in our studio in Washington is Bob Perry. He's a longtime investigative reporter based in Washington, D.C. He's previously worked for the Associated Press, Newsweek, PBS's Frontline, and he currently publishes IF Magazine and an online magazine called The Consortium. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bob.
Thank you.
Well, there's been a lot of to-do over Governor William Weld, I should say, the late Republican, former Republican Massachusetts Governor William Weld's support of the medical use of marijuana. And that seems to be the grounds that Jesse Helms is using to say that he's soft on drugs. But lost in this whole discussion is the former Governor Weld's real policies around drugs, particularly in the 1980s when he was, the number three man in the Justice Department?
Well, he was the Assistant Attorney General for Criminal Affairs at the Justice Department starting in, I think it was September of 1986.
Can you tell us a little about what he did there?
Well, he oversaw all criminal investigations being done by the Justice Department. One, of course, though, which I think one of your previous segments got into with Al McCoy's speech about the drug trafficking question, it would have been William Weld who oversaw the way the Justice Department reacted to growing numbers of allegations that were coming in by mid-1986 and then on 87-88 of contra drug trafficking. He was the one who would have either pushed those investigations forward or stopped them.
You know, it's interesting. One of the people on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, one of the Democrats, is Senator Kerry from Massachusetts. Of course, he ran against Weld for the Senate seat, and Kerry just eked out a victory over Weld. But Kerry and Weld go way back, not just because they're in Massachusetts, but because Senator John Kerry led the investigation in Washington into the whole Contra drug connection. Can you talk about what his connection was to the Justice Department and what Weld had to do with this?
Well, Amy, in September and October of 1986, this is before the Iran-Contra story broke wide open with the shooting down of the Hassanfuss plane in Nicaragua on October 5th, 86, and then the disclosures about the Iranian arms sales a month later. So right before then, in September and then early October of 1986, Senator Kerry brought to the Assistant Attorney General for Criminal Affairs, William Weld, evidence of Contra drug trafficking. It was building up. There was one particular witness that Senator Kerry tried to get Weld to deal with, a woman named Wanda Palacio. And Wanda Palacio had observed or given, she was an FBI informant, and she had given testimony, statements that she had observed cocaine being loaded onto planes from Southern Air Transport, which was a former CIA proprietary. And she said she saw this occurring while she was working with the Colombian drug cartels in Barranquilla, Colombia. And she gave rough dates. One of the dates was early October of 1985, roughly a year earlier. Kerry came forward with that. Weld, as happened with so many allegations about Contra drug trafficking, rejected her testimony. She was deemed not credible, although she'd been considered credible prior to making these allegations. And what happened next was sort of interesting because she was in the midst of being reviewed by justice and essentially being rejected when the Hassanfuss plane was shot down on October 5th, 1986. And she was in Kerry's office, Senator Kerry's office, when a photograph of the co-pilot of that plane was flashed on the television. If you remember, the plane that was shot down was a Southern Air Transport plane. And it was, the pilot was a man named Wallace Buzz Sawyer. She immediately said, that's the fellow. That's the guy I saw loading the cocaine on the plane in Barranquilla, Colombia in October of 1985. Mm-hmm. At which point the Kerry people thought this was rather unusual, but when we saw the records actually recovered from the plane shot down in Nicaragua, it turned out that Wallace Buzz Sawyer had been flying a Southern Air Transport plane into Barranquilla in early October of 1985, just as Ms. Palacio had said. However, still, William Weld rejected her and has continued to denounce her as not credible. We asked him about this during the campaign a year ago, and he said her credibility was roughly the same as a wagon load of diseased blankets. So he's continued to be very sensitive about this point, but I think he's also sensitive to the way the Justice Department handled this whole series of allegations around the Contra drug trafficking.
I remember when Weld and Kerry were involved in those series of debates when they were running for Senate last year. And in fact, in one of those debates at the very end, because of the Gary Webb series getting a lot of attention at the time, it was raised, but Kerry poo-pooed it. Kerry didn't get into it.
Well, he didn't really poo-poo it. He simply said that that he had made these allegations 10 years ago and that they seemed to have been correct. And he did not seize on the opening to attack Weld. He did finesse the question, that's true.
Right, he didn't seem to want to get into it, almost as if the opposition to the Kerry investigation had won out and that he felt that it was sort of he didn't want to be even identified with his own investigation. That's what I sort of felt, that it had somehow been discredited.
Well, Senator Kerry came under immense attacks from the Reagan administration in the mid-1980s. Much of that was picked up by the mainstream media. I was at Newsweek for a few years, and At one point, when they were on one of the conventional wisdom watches that Newsweek puts out, they described Kerry as a Randy conspiracy buff. The Kerry Report, when it was issued in 1989, even though it was extremely well documented, 1,000 pages, the mainstream press essentially ignored it. The Washington Post buried it on page A20 in a 700-word story. The New York Times, L.A. Times, others did roughly the same. So I think Kerry came out of that experience realizing that this was a very touchy area that he would only get grief from and come under a lot of political attack from the establishment. So he's always had he's been of two minds. I think he's proud of the work that was done, and it has stood up. But I think he also knows that he gets a lot of beatings for it and doesn't want to raise it when he doesn't have to.
We're talking to Bob Perry, longtime investigative reporter with Associated Press, with Newsweek, with PBS's Frontline, one of the people to really break the whole Contra-CIA story way back. Well, what happened at Newsweek when you tried to do that, or was it AP that you were working for at the time?
Well, AP was the first was the place where we wrote the first Contra drug story. I was working with Brian Barger, who's now with CNN. And in the fall of 85, as we were pursuing essentially the North Network story, and we'd done very early work on that, we stumbled upon, really, not wanting to, these numerous and increasing allegations from people inside the Contra movement that some of the units, actually pretty much all the groups, and not at all levels, but all the main Contra groups were involved in cocaine trafficking. And that they were being supported by Cuban Americans who were coming in from Miami who were also involved in cocaine trafficking, and they're working with the cartels in Colombia which were involved in cocaine trafficking. So we wrote the first story in December of 85, and we encountered a lot of resistance and fear on the part of editors to run those stories. We did finally get one out on December 20th, 85, which was the first story about this. And we tried to follow up on it through 86. However, we were constantly under attack. The Washington Times, owned by Reverend Sun Myung Moon, launched a front-page attack on us for doing this reporting. And that was pretty much the way it went. When I went to Newsweek, I encountered continuing opposition to the story, even as the evidence was building. It seemed like a story that the establishment in Washington was just deathly afraid of. I think they realized that this would raise serious questions about the legitimacy of the way the government does business. And I think that just was not something that the establishment press could deal with.
You told an interesting story last week at the National Press Club where you, Gary Webb, Jack White of Time Magazine, and Peter Kornbluh spoke about Gary Webb's series and the aftermath. Gary Webb from the San Jose Mercury News, who did the series last year that provoked this firestorm around the issue of was the CIA involved with bringing crack into South Central Los Angeles. Gary Webb has done a series of articles since then. The San Jose Mercury News has refused to publish them, and he's going to publish them in a book that he hopes to come out in the spring. But, Bob, you told a story about your own experience with the higher-ups in your organization about a dinner party where you were told to back off the story.
Well, there were a lot of messages, many of them quite blunt and clear, that at Newsweek in particular, the feelings were that the Newsweek top editors, particularly Maynard Parker, the editor, favored the Contras and that the Contras were supposed to win this war. So any stories that in some ways made the Contras look bad were not welcome. And there was also the concern about the Iran-Contra scandal, which was seen as undercutting both the CIA and the Contra operation. So we were supposed to essentially bury Iran-Contra. And as I think I mentioned at this speech or this conference, it reached the point that even when the congressional report on Iran-Contra came out in October of 87, I was told not to read it. The Newsweek did not want a story on it. I read it anyway, and I sort of forced them to deal with the story. And then in 89, when Oliver North went on trial, I was told that we would not cover the North trial because it was not a news story. Again, I fought that, but we were not able to attend because Newsweek chose not to attend the trial. Pacifica did, by the way. Larry Bensky was there.
That's right.
And then I was told later that there was a dinner party at Richard Holbrooke's house where Maynard Parker, the editor of Newsweek, had attended, and he sat next to Donald Gregg, who was the national security advisor to Vice President Bush during this period and very much involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. And the evening was spent, apparently, with Mr. Gregg complaining to my editor that about me, and I was told by Bureau Chief Evan Thomas the next day that the editor was furious that his dinner party had been ruined, and this was how the message comes down, that you're not supposed to pursue these stories. And so eventually I left Newsweek under rather painful terms. It was not I kept insisting that these were stories, that there was a cover-up of Iran-Contra going on, that we had an obligation to pursue these things. We had an obligation to pursue the Contra drug story, but it was just not shared at the highest levels of that magazine.
Well, Bob Perry, you continue to pursue this story and others in the consortium as well as IF Magazine. How can people reach you if they'd like to get a hold of your magazines?
Well, they can call. We have a toll-free number. It's 1-800-738-1812. It's 1-800-738-1812. And they can get IF Magazine, which is only $22 for a year subscription. We also have the reference to the Weld piece. We have a book, a small book we put together called Lost History, which contains the Weld information, which you can also get through that number.
And folks, if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Bob Perry has been our guest. His magazines are The Consortium, which is online, as well as IF Magazine. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Yes, William Weld, will he be ambassador to Mexico? Well, we're going to go down to Mexico City and talk about what's happening there today on Independence Day. Stay with us. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and today launches the month of National Latino Heritage Month. Today is also Independence Day in Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, and Nicaragua. And today we're going to go down to Mexico. Tens of thousands of Zapatista rebel supporters flooded into Mexico City's historic Zocalo District Square on Friday to welcome a caravan of Zapatista guerrillas. The 1,111 masked rebels set off on the four-day, 750-mile bus and foot trek from their jungle bases in the southern state of Chiapas early last week. To mark the establishment of a legal political group, the Zapatista Front, the FZLN, and to galvanize the indigenous movement in the country. We're joined now by two people from Mexico City. Isabel Molina is with us, a longtime activist and former deputy with the PRD, that's the Revolutionary Democratic Party. She's with Obando and Gill Foundation, which deals with victims of violence in Mexico City. We're also joined by John Ross, who's a freelance journalist and author of the forthcoming book, The Annexation of Mexico, From the Aztecs to the IMF, which will be published by Common Courage Press. He has spent many years in Mexico and actually went with the Zapatistas on their march. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Hi.
Why don't we begin with John? Can you tell us what transpired over this last week, what this march was all about?
Well, the march, as you mentioned, was constituted by the Zapatistas to come up to Mexico City for a number of reasons. There's a number of subtexts. One was basically the establishment of a civilian political formation not necessarily a Zapatista political formation, but one which would involve people that sympathize with the Zapatistas and follow Zapatista principles, basically not seeking power and attempting to transform the society from down below, the Frente FCLN, or the Frente Zapatista de Liberación Nacional. There were a number of other reasons why this march was conducted. Basically, the Congress now has a opposition majority, if you take the four opposition parties together, and the new legislature can, in fact, enact laws that will reflect the agreements that were reached with the Cedillo government in February of 1996, but which the Cedillo government has refused until now to submit to Congress. And even a third context here is statement that Marcos, the very charismatic spokesperson for the Zapatistas, made at the very beginning of the march, which implies that the Zapatistas were coming to Mexico City, which is will be ruled from December 5th onwards by Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas and the Party of the Democratic Revolution, the PRD, the first opposition mayor of this town, first elected mayor of this town, to keep the PRD honest, essentially to allow, permit the quieting of more radical voices, both within the PRD and outside of the PRD. So March had a number of political reasons. One other reason, of course, was the convening of the second Congress, National Indigenous Congress, here in Mexico City, in which the Zapatistas have played an important role in formulating. This Congress now includes most of the 56 distinct indigenous groups in the country and is fast becoming a very important force in terms of organizing in the poorest communities in Mexico.
I have to say, in all this discussion about Mexico, of which there's been a lot lately because of the whole controversy over William Weld and will he become ambassador to Mexico, we have heard very little about what the Zapatistas are doing. Can you describe what the actual march was like? You started in Chiapas.
We started in San Cristóbal de las Casas, which is, of course, the highland city where the rebellion first manifested itself on January 1st, 1994. Boarded 30 buses and set off through western southern Mexico, the most indigenous region in the country, made stops along the way in towns like Juchitán, Oaxaca City, Huahuapan de León, where there are 16 separate indigenous nations in the state of Oaxaca. All of them joined the march. The march grew from town to town. We started with 30 buses and wound up with 100 vehicles. We started with 1,111 Zapatistas, one for each community, wound up with over 4,000 people. And, of course, it slowed the march down continually so that we had meetings and marches in various cities. And in Oaxaca, the meeting, in fact, lasted until 3:30 in the morning. In Tepoztlán, Morelos, from which we followed the Zapata's trail down to Mexico City, the one he took in 1914 to meet with Pancho Villa, where the north met the south, probably the apogee of the Mexican Revolution. The meeting went on till 4:30 in the morning. Rained most of the time. Many of the Zapatistas arrived here sick. Many are tired. But here, of course, we were met by a group in Xochimilco, the part of the city that Villa and Zapata had met in 1914. And then a march was conducted from the monument of the heroic children, the Niños Héroes, to the Zócalo. The Zócalo being the great central plaza where over 100,000 people, perhaps 150,000 people, were on hand to greet the Zapatistas. I've never seen a demonstration, at least in this year of high political activity. I haven't seen such an outpouring, even for Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas' final closing rallies. And in fact, the rallies reflected the biggest crowds I've seen in the Zócalo since the 1988 elections were stolen from Cárdenas. So it was a great amount of jubilation. The city welcomed them with open arms, in contrast to the way the city greeted the original Zapatistas back in 1914 with much fear and trepidation. And since then, they have appeared at the opening session of the Zapatista National Liberation Front, so did Cuauhtemoc Cardenas, and they appeared yesterday at the opening of the National Indigenous Congress in near some Aztec rooms in which the richest man in Latin America, Carlos Slim, is trying to construct some condominiums, so they're taking part in political action here in the city as well.
John Ross, freelance journalist who followed the Zapatistas from San Cristobal Las Casas, where they started their march, though much of that march was done by bus, and ended up in Mexico City this weekend. Isabel Molina is also with us, longtime activist and former deputy with the PRD, the Revolutionary Democratic Party. She's with the Abandon Gil Foundation, which deals with victims of violence, and she's on the transition team of Cuauhtemoc Cardenas, who is the mayor-elect of Mexico City. What about politics in Mexico City right now? Why do you think there was this just tremendous outpouring, as John is describing, in Mexico City when the Zapatistas came in?
Well, the Zapatistas have captured the imagination of Mexico, in Mexico and abroad, because of the justice of the cause they're struggling for. They represent the poorest of the poor, the people that have most suffered because of the economic situation in the country. And I think that there's enormous sympathy towards their cause.
Besides that,
there's been an awakening, a political awakening in Mexico. In Mexico City particularly, I think there's a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of optimism because we have finally managed to win an election over the ruling official party. And this has made people more participative, more enthusiastic, more active. We're beginning to lose our fear of participating politically. And this also helped make this crowd of welcome for the Zapatistas.
How did these feelings translate, make their way into the Mexican Congress?
You mean...
Is there any effect, I should say?
Well, the most evident effect is the fact that the PRI no longer has an absolute majority. And and it changes the panorama completely. Because now the opposition, if they organize themselves and manage to continue functioning as a bloc, will be able to, and are already in fact beginning to, make certain changes in the way Congress functions. Although we must caution you not to be overly optimistic in this sense, because even though the PRI doesn't have an absolute majority in the Chamber of Deputies, it still has a majority in the Senate and in most of the state congresses. Therefore, a lot of they're going to be able to effectively block a lot of the initiatives that we could take. So we have to be very careful and try to negotiate and achieve consensus. We can't just overrule them easily as if we had a majority in the other chamber.
Isabel Molina.
And also, there's a risk that the opposition bloc, it's a very fragile bloc. You must think that there are the two main parties in this bloc, one is right-wing and one is center-left-wing. So we actually have different points of view on certain topics, especially in regard to economic policy. So it'll be, it's a very delicate balance.
Where does the Obando and Gil Foundation fit in dealing with victims of violence?
Well, the Obando and Gil Foundation is actually a foundation that was formed by the PRD, the Party of the Democratic Revolution, to help the people in our party that have been victims of political violence. Not very many people are aware of the fact that about 560 PRD members have been murdered in the past 9 years, that is, from the Salinas regime, 1988 on. In fact, during the Salinas regime, about 270 people were murdered. And in the Cedillo regime, there's even been more violence, although there's less awareness of it. I think that one of the reasons this violence can be explained is because of the increased military presence in the states. If you analyze where the violence is located against the PRD, it's mainly in Guerrero, Oaxaca, Chiapas, and Michoacán. These are the four states that concentrate the violence. And the violence has generally been directed against people that are trying to change the situation locally, local leaders. what the PID is trying to do through this foundation is to help their families. Most of these people come from very, very poor communities, and when the head of the family, the father, is killed, because most of the murders have been men, the people murdered have been men, the family is left completely destitute. And so what we're doing is we're giving the children, the orphans, scholarships so that they can continue studying. We're trying to also help the widows to earn a little bit of money and trying to develop productive projects for them so they can be self-sufficient.
John Ross,
the party is financing this foundation.
John Ross, let me ask you something. Isabel was just talking about the militarization, particularly in the southern states. You've just come from the south following the Zapatista March. What about that? When I was covering the Zapatistas in 1994 during the peace negotiations with the Mexican government, of course, there was a tremendous military presence then because it was just a few months after the Zapatistas had risen up. How does it compare to today?
Well, the militarization has really spread itself out. There's perhaps 26,000 Mexican Army troops in and around the conflict zone. That's the Altos, the highlands, and the jungles in Chiapas. But with the development of the Popular Revolutionary Army in Guerrero, declared itself in June of 1996, has waged a sporadic guerrilla attack on police and military installations throughout a number of southern and central Mexican states. That military presence has, of course, increased and now extends from the Huasteca Mountains on the eastern side of the Caribbean side of the country through some of the poorest states in the Union, throughout the state of Guerrero, throughout the state of Oaxaca, and throughout the state of Chiapas and Tabasco, and has spread itself into the southeast, into the Yucatan Peninsula. There's particular problems in the state of Campeche, as I'm sure Isabel knows. Today, a governor who was falsely elected will be sworn in, and military has been called out for that. And in Mexico City, in 19 states, I think it's 19, 20 states, out of the 31 entities in Mexico, the military now runs the police force. And in Mexico City, they not only run the police force, but they are also the police on the streets. There's been tremendous conflict here. And in effect, we have seen in the last year in Mexico a militarization of civil authority. And this has resulted in wholesale human rights abuses, not only the PRD, which has suffered an enormous amount of victims, but an organization called FACT Milan, I won't go into its initials, has over 250 political prisoners, a number of deaths. The EZLN, of course, has suffered numbers of casualties and incarcerations. And in fact, while this question of democracy is being celebrated by the government, the truth is there are probably more political prisoners and probably more political deaths in Mexico now than there has been in a number of years.
Certainly not something we hear about. Finally, John, the mainstream press has played the whole march over the last few days as reviving, trying to sort of get a jump start, the Zapatistas, on politics again or on the whole movement. Do you see it that way?
Well, I think the Zapatistas have been here. They will be here. Marcos, when the Zapatistas did not comment very very loudly on the elections, Marcos sent a communique that said, silence is an Indian weapon. And I think we need to remember that. The other Indian weapon is history. And they have demonstrated that history still lives here in these last couple of days in a way that has been come home very strongly to the country at the most patriotic time of the season, the most patriotic season. I just want to add one thing. There's another patriotic holiday today that is being marked, not celebrated, and that is the 150th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Mexico. On this day in 1847, the U.S. flag flew over the National Palace in Mexico, and subsequently 51% of Mexico's national territory was annexed by the United States. That is not being forgotten here. And it's a point that I think is probably going to be overlooked up north. But please make note that that is part of what is being marked here at this very important time of year.
John, it is duly noted. I want to thank you very much for joining us, John Ross. His new book is called The Annexation of Mexico, From the Aztecs to the IMF, published by Common Courage. He's also the author of Roots of Rebellion, Indian Uprising in Chiapas, which was an American Book Award winner. Isabel Molina, thank you also for joining us. She's formerly a deputy, PRD deputy, that's Party of the Democratic Revolution, and is with the Obando and Gila Foundation, which deals with victims of violence, on the transition team of Cuauhtemoc Cardenas. And how can we forget the dog whose bark has now been heard across the country? If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you'd like to reach us by email, our address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. And you can hear us on the web, or tell your friends who perhaps don't get Democracy Now! On their public radio station. They can hear us on the web at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland engineered from New York. Andy York is our Washington engineer, thanks to Mario Murillo. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!